Good morning. This is the Education Subcommittee for Ways and Means. We have another great day in front of us. Today is May 19th. I was going to say we're still on the 18th. And today I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 5016. And this is something that I think many people are going to, I think we're going to reap a lot of information today, and we have a number of slides to go through. And so we have 2 days for this, but we also, we can, you know, questions are always, you know, important, but we need to keep on moving if you're getting my information. And we have a couple members that are going to be leaving to testify. Don't think that they're walking out on the hearing. They have some pretty important testimony in another committee, so please don't think that we're not interested or anything else. Mr. Wilson.
Madam Chair, members, just to set the stage a little bit as Mr. Saxton comes forward. Today and tomorrow, talking about strategic investments and the network, again, you've heard some things about that. I think today, or this presentation, will go into more depth. The importance of this is trying to sort through what will be funded, and so that's the information that's going to be brought forward so you can decide on, help make the decision on what gets funded in these two areas in the grant and aid budgets, along with the early learning, which you heard more or quite a bit about, what is it, a week and a half ago, I've lost count. But, and those two things make up sort of the amount of money that's coming out of that mysterious $60 million pot. So that's why the importance there, because you could spend many, many more dollars than $60 million between this and the early learning. A couple notes. This is scheduled for 2 days, but also tomorrow there is a grant from community colleges and workforce development that you need to hear, which should only take a matter of minutes, and also House Bill 3499, which is the English language learners work session only. So out in the audience and out in the internet land, they will not be taking any public testimony. It's a work session only on 3499, which is the English language learners bill. So that work session should not take too much time on that either, I don't think. So with that, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson. Senator Monroe, Mr. Co-Chair.
Yeah, Madam Co-Chair, I just want to make sure that the other members of the committee know that you and I are having multiple meetings with ODE, with the governor's staff, with the big co-chairs, trying to come up with firm recommendations in terms of education budgets. And as soon as we have that information, we will share it with all of you. Working very hard now that the forecast has come.
Any questions from the committee before Mr. Saxton starts? Well, thank you. And Rob, welcome. And I know you've been working hard on this, and so as Ed Sullivan would say, take it away.
Co-chair's compliment.
Oh, gosh, I'm old.
Members of the committee, it's a pleasure to be here today. Rob Saxton, Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction, for the record. Senator Monroe and Representative Huffman, thank you for the memo on purple today. Please include Senator Roblin in future communication.
We ought to have a picture.
I wanted to start off today taking a deeper dive into the strategic initiatives that came out of the 2013 legislative session and telling you more about what they did, what they cost, what we learned, and what kind of results that we're seeing. I also want to provide information about what we're asking for this session, and it's an important topic we have scheduled just today and part of tomorrow, and so I will be moving quickly. There might be some places where I try to move real quickly. Please don't hesitate to slow me down or speed me up, either one. Before I get too far into the presentation, though, I do want to create a specific mindset about what we're attempting to accomplish. So our identified target for education in the state is 40-40-20. And I think everybody knows what that means, so I'm not going to go through it. But it's a really specific target, and right now we don't approach that target. But what we're trying to do with these strategic initiatives is generate tangible progress toward that intended outcome. And I think that's a really important thing for us to keep in mind and consider as we talk about these things and think about what they can do and what they can't do to move us towards our 40-40-20 objective. Some of the initiatives that I'm going to talk about are large. In fact, they're large enough that with their implementation, we would expect to see outcomes improve across the state. Some of them are scale-up efforts of things that happened prior to the invention of 40-40-20. So there are things that were going well in places, but in small silos that we looked at and said, we think we could replicate those on a bigger scale and make a big difference across the state. Others of them are fairly small. They actually are things that we received funding for in the last biennium, knowing that we were going to pilot them someplace, look at the outcomes that we get, and make determinations about whether or not that's something that we shouldn't scale up on a bigger scale as we move forward into this biennium. And so I want to talk about each one of those things and be a little bit specific where possible about which is which. So the strategic initiatives in 13-15 and proposed 15-17 are on this on slide number 2 here. And it's a little bit awkward to start here because I feel like I'm starting at the end. But I also know that if I don't answer this question fairly soon, that it will be asked of me anyway, and that is this part of the $60 million? We certainly have heard that question asked a number of times, and it's a really appropriate question. And so I want to try to answer that question to some degree on these next two slides. So I'm going to start off with a big representation of what it is that we're asking for in 32-32 and in 32-33. So in 32-32, we're seeking $28.27 million for funding in 15-17. And if you look at this slide, what you'll see is a column that indicates the funding that we had for the various initiatives in 13-15 and how that currently has changed for 15-17. And that the requests really for 15-17 reside mostly at the bottom of the slide, with the regional promise, which would be scale up of what we used to refer to as the Eastern Promise that we're now trying to refer to as just the regional promise. I'll talk about why that is. The STEM regional hubs and STEM for underserved students, an attendance pilot for our Oregon tribes, a move of the survey that we did around what was called the TEL survey that would go to OEIB instead of reside at ODE. It just sort of is a technical shift in budget from one agency to another. A GED initiative, $2 million, effective teacher preparation program at 1, strengthening professional development around assessments at 2.8, and then school and district turnaround at 2.9 for a total of 28.75. And you can see that's just a couple million dollars more than what came out of the last session in 13-15, but there are some things that are not being repeated that we had resources for in 13-15. It simply is part of leveraging what we think is going to work best. And this is the same kind of representation, only with 13-15. You'll see a difference when you go to the bottom of the page, $45 million versus $34.5 million. The main difference there is that there was $12 million in one-time-only funding. I believe that funding came out of the Common School Fund. In the last biennium, we've not sought dollars out of the Common School Fund this time, and so it reduces that amount by roughly 11 or 12 million. And the educator mentoring and school district collaboration grants largely continue, a slight increase in the collaboration. The support for implementation of the Common Core State Standards is reduced significantly from 5 to 1.5 because we've made a lot of progress in that implementation. Closing the achievement gap at $5 million we're requesting, and then support for underperforming districts at $4 million. And it would be my intent over the course of the next day and a half, roughly, to go over each of these and explain some rationale. But the point that I would really want to make is that total $62.77 million, those two combined, and they really represent a roll-up, if you will, of the old 32-32 and the old 32-33. And fit within roughly within $60 million. They don't include some of the things around early learning, but I do believe that there were these dollars that were available from 32-32, 32-33, and then another $60 million that came in the co-chair's budget. And so I'll try to create some space around that, and it would be my intent at the end of the presentation to get to a place where I can say, and I think we can make this all fit, or at least be close. Okay. Out of the 2013 session, we had two bills that were supporting the strategic initiatives, and I've kind of talked about these, obviously. 3232, but I want to be specific that that was really primarily about initiatives intended to support student success. So it was, how can we move the kinds of outcomes that we have with students? And that was what the resources in 3232 were for. And in 3233, it was primarily about improved teaching and learning. We called it the Network for Quality Teaching and Learning. Certainly, $32-$33 are supposed to move student outcomes, right? Because good teaching and learning will do that. But it's a little bit of a longer lead item, right? We are going to improve our practice as educators and how we interact with students, and eventually we'll begin to see outcomes. 3232 are funds that are intended to see a little bit quicker turnaround because they are an actual initiative at a spot. There were 33 initiatives overall, and it led to more than 1,200 grant recipients of funds, which is fairly interesting. They went out to, there were about $70.8 million, and they went to a variety of providers, all totaled 196 school districts, which is all but one school district. Of course, people then would ask, well, who didn't? Riverdale did not receive any resources simply because they did not choose to take them. I don't know why, but they chose not to take them.
You got too much money already.
I'll certainly leave the editorial comments to the senator, but they were offered in several instances, and they just didn't take them. So there were 19 ESDs. All of them received at least some funds, 20 post-secondary institutions, all 9 federally recognized sovereign tribes, and 52 community-based organizations and nonprofits. So a lot of different recipients. These initiatives were targeting specific outcomes along the education continuum. We're operating under the belief that if you can achieve certain specific key outcomes along their trajectory, really from birth to graduate school, that you can change the overall outcome, and that high school graduate ready for college or career and eventual populace of 40-40-20. And so I'm not going to go through the whole list of targets. I know that you've heard and seen those and graphics and everything else a number of times, but certainly having students being ready for kindergarten that comes out of early learning and show up ready to learn is a key step along the pathway. We want to make sure that we have resources that are designed to accomplish that. Being able to read at the end of third grade, and I've talked about that ad nauseum here, so I won't do that again. Ninth grade on track. When students are on track at the end of ninth grade, they are much more likely to graduate from high school and then college enrollment. So I will talk about some of the things that we did that target those kinds of outcomes. On 3233, we invest where we've recognized that real learning takes place in school, which is in schools, and even more specifically in the classroom. We know that when we have capable leaders in schools focused on the right work, improving the delivery of instruction, and teachers who have the support to be their very best, that we see learning significantly advanced for students. And the strategic initiatives in 3233 targeted that specifically, providing resources for professional development, recruitment, retention, and mentoring, and creation of career advancement opportunities for teachers at each stage of their career. I believe that I've shown you this this map before. Last time I made it interactive and it took a second. I'm not going to take the time to do that today. And Representative Springer, I would need to show her the resources at Lebanon got one more time. But the bottom line is this was really spread out across the state. I know that at times this work has been criticized that we didn't get enough money to rural school districts. And that just simply I don't believe is the case. We spread these resources. Every district got some, except one. And many districts got more than just those dollars that were put out on a formula basis. And bottom line is, we know that when people say, I'm ready to do something, and I want the resources so that I can deliver, and you provide them with those resources with some strings attached, with some sideboards, they get to work on moving the objectives that I've talked about. And if you sort of say, here's the money, take it, sometimes you don't get the outcome that you're looking for. These are groups who were ready. They are ready to step up and say, I want to do this. They're ready to write a grant. They're ready to engage with their community and their teachers and make the outcomes happen that we were hoping to see happen. And I feel like we largely were able to accomplish that.
Representative Smith-Warner.
Thank you, and thank you, Rob. I'm already enjoying it, and I look forward to continuing to. Just a quick question about this. Do you guys have, or could you get us this broken out as a kind of per student basis at all? Because it is, you know, you obviously think about, well, yeah, the different size counties, and that accounts for the differing dollar amount, you know, not right now, but it would be helpful and maybe interesting to kind of get a sense of, if you know how much went into the county and then you can divide it by how many students in that district, that would be an interesting way to look at it.
Co-chairs Compton, Monroe, Rosen, Smith, Warner, yes, we can do that, and we'll go to work on that this afternoon. I'm not sure that it isn't in the interactive map, but I don't have it up, so I can't look at it for you. But we'll find out, and we'll get you that information.
And you can send us a link if it's in something already.
That actually would be really interesting for me to see as well.
Well, and Rob, I really appreciate the color coding because, yeah, it really adds a different dimension to know that you have the dollar figures there. But thank you. That's really nice.
Thank you, Co-Chair Comp. I know that I had one person I used to work with in a district who is now a superintendent in a district who said, we're going to get 8 of these grants. When the grants were sort of identified, we're going to get 8 of these grants. And just set out to cause that to happen and really is driving delivery to kids, and it's fun to watch. So that's a neat way to go. The award process, I'm going to talk, I don't want to get too deep here, but I'll just get too deep into this, but here's what I will say. There are some people in the room behind me, and I know when I start to list them, I'll forget a couple of people. Blake Dye, who helped support this work, Sarah Pope, Sum Glashen, and the entire Department of Education. This was a really big piece of work for us that we hadn't done before. And we came in front of you last session and said, we can make this work. And it was even way more than what I thought. I don't want to not recognize Cindy Hunt for all the work that they did to actually allow us to be able to do this. One of the things that we needed to do is even develop an award process. How do we want to think about how we want to put these grants out? And we really had probably too fast of a start. We began to create grant processes and get dollars out as quickly as we possibly could. And part of it was that the bills got signed in August, and we wanted to have the teacher mentoring grant money in the hands of mentor districts or mentees and mentors as quickly before they started the school year. They needed mentoring. There were brand new teachers who were showing up and working. And so we probably did move too quick. It gave me a small amount of pleasure, as I've said multiple times, to have anybody say that we were moving too quickly, because I don't think that people had accused us of that previously. So it felt a little bit good to do that, but the process that we went through is detailed here. I'm not going to walk you through every step. I think it's important for you to know that we had very, very few people come and say, I don't think that you followed a good process in your grant awarding, and we're going to contest something. That maybe happened once or twice in all the awarding that we did, and the people who led this and were dedicated enough to read through each one of the grants and make determinations about where the dollars were to go, just did a really nice job. We committed eventually to always give at least 4 weeks to any interested parties to submit their grant application. So we would announce, this is it, you have 4 weeks now to get your grant in. We started off at about 2 weeks, and it was too fast. And then we also were committed then, once the grants were in, to tell people if they got the dollars or not within 15 days. Which is pretty quick turnaround, but what we didn't want to do is have money languish and then come here and still have people sitting on grant dollars in large measure in this session. We had 2 years to deliver or not, and we wanted to prove up. You'll see here in this slide how the dollars were divided up. $70 million basically went out and is divided up as indicated by the pie chart. You'll see that the majority of strategic investment funds were distributed directly to school districts to support the implementation of the Common Core, it's the big brown one down there at the bottom, Common Core State Standards, teacher and administrator evaluation systems that were new to schools in 2013, and really just under 50% when you count the collaboration grants, mentoring, Common Core implementation, and educator effectiveness with the supporting teachers, which makes sense since that was 32-33. The next biggest was STEM and CTE, college going at 18%, I think. See, where am I? Well, connected to the world work at 11%, and then if you combine up a couple of those other ones. And I'm not going to go through all of it, but that's how the dollars went out. We let the awards out in four grant cycles, and here you can see the timelines that we put out by which we put out the grant awards. We met the timelines across the board. We said that we would, and we needed to prove that we could do that. You provided the resources, and we needed to be close to perfect. The first cycle, we did get out before school started, and you can imagine that it was a pretty good scramble when at the same time we also needed to hire staff up to do that. Jonna Timms and Blake Dye, who we hired to help with that, and then people to run and support the delivery work. And at the same time, the Early Learning Division and YDD were joining the department, and we had some hiring to do, and they had grant work to do as well. So lots going on at that point in time. And it impacted every part of the department, HR, business function, facilities, technology, in every single department. The long-term initiatives. So these four initiatives are longer-term initiatives, and I want to get into specifics of each of these, but especially these because they've been around for quite a while. And the reason that they've been around for a while is because that they're programs that were already in place on a smaller scale that were successful. I mentioned these in my opening statement, that became strategic initiatives in 2013, and they were out in districts or they're out in regions, and we scaled them up because they were working so well someplace. And they're the best initiatives at providing us with information about their impacts, mostly because they've been up and running for a while, and so we could see the kind of outcomes that we were getting with students. And I know that Representative Smith-Warner sometimes says, what are the results? And on some of the grants, I'm going to say, we don't have results yet. They're just too new. These are not that. These are ones that we have results because they've been in place for a while, either on smaller scale or because they're on bigger scale, we could make them happen very quickly because we had good example and we're beginning to see results out of the dollars that were lent to that from 2013. So collaboration grant, you see the list there. The first is the school district collaboration grants, and I've always assumed it's called the collaboration grants because of the collaborative nature of the work that gets done between teachers and the district at implementing the work. But it's an innovative initiative designed to empower teachers and raise student achievement, built around four components linked to effective teaching: expanded career paths, effective performance evaluations, relevant professional development, and new compensation models. About 40% of all Oregon students and 30% of teachers are in what we would call either class or school district collaboration grant. It used to be called the class grant. With this, we called it the school district collaboration grants. And the technical assistance for this is provided by the Chalkboard Project. These are some outcome results that we see from the first cadres of this work. And they show some really good results, quite impressive. We go back to 2013. They're broken out demographically, these results are, and show the gap between the collaboration districts and the rest of the state in student achievement in math and English language arts. So just to orient you to this graph, I'm going to look at the top two, which are the Sherwood and Tillamook school districts, the first two districts that signed on to the collaboration grants. And the results they had in 13-14 would show you that with all students, their results are 9.4% higher than the rest of the state on reading. And their results are 12.8% higher than the rest of the state on mathematics. And then if you look at the demographic breakouts, you'll see that there is pretty good margin. Admittedly, when you get to black at 29.8 and 23, Tillamook and Sherwood are not districts that have large African-American populations in the state. But at the same time, they're obviously doing something right with the students that are there. There are fairly significant Hispanic population, particularly in Tillamook. And so that would be one to take a look at. If you move on to group two, Albany, Bend, Crook County, Redmond, Salem, Kaiser, and Sisters, you don't see as big of a difference in those. And yet there is a difference, and there certainly is a difference on the demographic breakouts. I'll move down to group three and group four. Again, a pretty good difference in group three, not as big a difference in group four. What you don't see here are some of the districts that were funded out of the next two groups, which were groups five and group six. So let me just tell you about that very quickly. Group five, which came out of 2013 resources, are North Santiam, and Andy Gardner, the superintendent of that district, is here and may mention that today at some point when he comes up. and talk about, he could talk about how incredible that work is. Hood River County, Klamath Falls City, Silver Falls, Phoenix Talent, and then in Group 6, Eagle Point, Philomath, Rainier, Central, Medford, Rogue River, Dayton, Perrydale, Sheridan, St. Paul. And we have planning in the first year and implementation for the 13-15 group. So there is a one-year planning that comes with this grant and then actual implementation in the next year. So North Santa Am and that group in Group 5 did the planning last year, and they're in implementation this year, and we'll have results on student achievement as soon as the assessment results are in from this spring with that group. And then the other group, Group 6, is in the implementation phase this year, the planning phase this year, I apologize, planning, and not implementation. We'll see results next spring from their work. We been awarded $12.3 million in the budget process from you all in the last session for this. We're asking for $14 million in this session. It more or less is a roll-up, maybe a slight increase in our ability to deliver. And there'll be both support of current districts that from Group 5 and 6, and then some new districts that would have the opportunity to begin this work. And it's really strong around helping teachers be at their very best, and administrators as well. So I'll shift to the beginning teacher and administrator mentoring goals. our intent here is to increase retention, improved instruction, and increase student learning with the beginning teacher and administrator mentoring programs. These are the grants that I always say we needed to get out so quickly. When you look at this, this is a long-term grant project. The Department of Education has previously used some funds, I believe federal funds, but has used some funds to do the mentoring program as early as 2008. And you can see, I like the third one down, says 975 beginning teachers, and then fifth one down, 53 beginning administrators in 2008, 2009. And you can see that there are some vagaries in funding on that as you move across to the numbers of teachers. And part of that is how many new teachers there really were in the state, by the way, in 2009, 2010, or 2010, 2011, we were in the middle of the recession. And then also our ability to support that. And if you go out to 13, then all of a sudden you see this big jump, 980 through three new teachers that were supported. And then in 14, 15, 1,175 new teachers, beginning administrators, 97 and 47 respectively. And with what we see happening this year, advent of full day K, I would anticipate that there are going to be approximately 1,000 new teachers just at the elementary level. Most of them won't be kindergarten teachers, by the way, right? People think that, oh, there's going to be 1,000 new kindergarten teachers. Lots of first and second grade experienced teachers will become kindergarten teachers, and lots of new teachers will become first and second grade teachers because there's a lot of import around kinder, although I'm sure some new kinder teachers will be added as well. But with this grant, with the dollars that we had, roughly 2,000 new teachers and 140 new administrators were served over the course of the biennium, and they received mentoring. There are a number of different ways to think about this. One of our goals was around retention, and we have a study that is underway right now. We'll have more data on this, I hope, before July 1, that tells us about what's happening. But I like this one. When you look at new teachers, 77% are retained that have a mentor, and only 64% that do not, which is pretty remarkable. And the opportunity dollars that are lost when we replace teacher, we educate them, and then we turn them over that quickly, is problematic. And so this is something that is having an impact and is important for us to recognize. There are some other data bits, but a lot of that is from surveying that we did, like we ask them a question, does mentoring program improve performance in your classroom? And 88% of those mentored say yes, it does. Or 85% of new teachers mentored attribute at least some of their success to the mentoring program. And those are important things for us to know. New teachers say that are mentored obviously stay on more than do others. The request and what we received last time was $9.6 million to support this. 15-17, we're seeking $10 million. Really probably does not meet roll-up cost, but it's a nice round number, and it's in the ballpark.
Mr.
Co-Chair.
I guess these numbers validate your effort and my effort over the last 8 years to implement and spread teacher mentoring as a major part of our education process in this state. When we came onto this job back in 07, 09, there wasn't much mentoring going on, and Betty and I worked very hard to build this program, and it looks like it's being successful.
Co-chairs Compton and Monroe, I agree that it is, and we'll have even some more data on this relatively soon that I think you'll find very positive.
Yes, Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Rob. Indeed, it continues to be very interesting. Let me ask you just two questions about both of these in the current, as you talk about current and then the proposed. In both the mentoring and the earlier one, the school-based collaboration, for the ongoing funding, and this might be a different answer for both, is that in the school-based collaboration, is that continuing in those schools, or will this be expanding to other schools, or both?
Co-chairs Compton, Representative Smith Warner.
Are these 2-year programs? Are they 5-year programs?
On the collaboration grants, there is a cycle to it where first year is planning, second year is implementation, and then there's a couple of years of support, and then there's an expectation that that work continues forward. And then new schools would come on. So these resources would support those who currently have been in to finish the trajectory of this work, and then some new cadres would come on.
Great.
When I went through that, and I'll just do this very quickly, and it's going to be imprecise, but in group 5 there were 17 districts that were added out of the funding that we received in 13-15, and I would guess it would be something like that as we move into 15-17. Part of it is how big is the district. So if you get Portland Public, you know, maybe there's 2. If it's Rainier, maybe there are 17.
Gotcha. And then same question for the mentoring program. Is that is this continuing to mentor those folks, or a combination of continuing and new?
Thank you,
opportunities.
Representative Smith Warner. Yes, this would be a reapplication of dollars. We actually have talked about the allocation of these dollars differently than we did last time. There were lots of grants last time, a lot of feedback about whether or not grant was good, bad, or someplace in between. And in some places, it's really appropriate, maybe not so much in other places. For the mentoring grant, as we're moving forward, what we've talked about is really targeting districts that have populations that have been historically underserved and might require a very special kind of mentoring and teacher in order to generate support. So in places where there's lots of poverty or students of color, we'd like to focus our mentoring efforts, and less so in some other places.
Okay. Thank you.
But they would be new.
Right.
Relatively, the program that we use for this specifically is a program that came out of the Center for, I'm going to lose the name of it, but it's a research center that does research about effective mentoring programs. There's a very specific design, the number of hours you need to mentor, what you do while you're mentoring, and how the whole program works. And it really is, if you want the dollars, this is the program. This is not negotiable. You're going to design your own program.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Well, and if I might make a comment, and the other part of this is when those initial mentors are developed, then they become their coaches. Mm-hmm. For the school district, and then it creates a cycle of long-term initiatives so that they're self-supporting.
Thank you.
I'm going to talk a little bit about response to intervention, or the Oregon Response to Intervention Initiative, and I have a person to help me with this today, Wendy Wilson, who's the principal at John Wetton Elementary School in Gladstone. And so if she wanted to join me now, that would be great. I'll talk a little bit about RTI, and then Wendy's going to talk a little bit about her experience with RTI at her elementary school.
Great.
Thanks for being here today, and we'll get to the introduction here in a second.
All righty.
Okay. So, reorient myself here. All right. Thank you. The Oregon Response to Intervention Program and this effort was designed to scale up evidence-based model to improve student outcomes, and it really is about supporting high-quality reading programs, increasing the percentage of students who were meeting the benchmark of reading at third grade, and reduce the percentage of students that are identified as having a learning disability, special education. And it really has shown a lot of evidence to work well in all of those things. It's a program that's been in place on a smaller scale since 2006, I think, in the Tiger-Tualatin School District, when we began RTI scale up across the state with support from with professional development that was provided through a contract with the Tiger-Tualatin School District. Approximately 84 school districts have now participated in this program, and so this is something that we've taken to a pretty good scale at this point in time. Some of the results that we've been able to see long-term on this are really pretty impressive. Here we see on slide 22 that of the school districts participating in the Oregon RTI and the project for 2 to 5 years, a majority, 19 out of 24, which is right at 80%, decreased the percentage of third grade students identified as high risk. So the districts do universal screenings to see how students are doing, and it reduces significantly how many of their third graders are identified as high risk. And the high risk status typically is because they're not proficient readers. On the other side of that, of districts funded in 2013, 6 out of 7 decreased the percentage of third graders in the high risk range. Only one increased slightly. So if you think about the very first district reducing by 14.2% the percentage of students that were identified as high risk, it really is a nice piece of work. All 7 districts funded in 2013, conversely, increased the percentage of proficient readers at third grade. So not just reducing how many are high risk, but then also increasing, of course, then the percentage of students that are identified as readers. And it was all of them.
And Rob, were some of these students, would they have typically in the past been identified as special ed potentially?
Co-Chair Comp, thank you for the question. Yes, my experience with RTI is that we used to have in identification of special education what a lot of people refer to as a wait to fail model. We'd start to teach them, we'd treat them like they were a typical student, we'd just teach them as we taught all students, basically. It's probably a little overstatement, but more or less. And then when the gap in their learning was big enough to identify through a test, and we didn't have tests that we could really even give kids very well that they could take to identify that they had a learning gap, when the gap got big enough, then we would test them for special identification or special education, and we'd identify them as such, and then we would go to work on them. But we had this huge learning gap that we had to overcome then to even support them. With response to intervention, you bring students in and you say, we're going to universally screen all students and see where they are, and if any kind of a deficit comes up, we're going to attack that deficit with intensive intervention. And then we're going to remeasure and see if it's working. And if it works, great. And if it doesn't work, then let's try something new. Yeah. And if that doesn't work, then let's try something new. But it has to be really evidence-based. This is something that we know scientifically works to improve reading opportunities for kids or reading outcomes for kids. Because you're about to make, if they continue to not progress, even though you're putting in really strong intervention, you're about to make a really profound legal and life-changing decision. This student probably has a learning disability. And that pronouncement has all kinds of legal and sort of psychological and delivery implications. And yet, we spend enough time with response to intervention to know that it works and it withstands the legal challenge of identification. And the best part of all is you don't wait to see if a student's going to fail. If you don't do anything to help a kid, you're going to identify lots of students as having a learning disability when they don't.
Right.
If you immediately begin to intervene, it might just be that they didn't have a very strong vocabulary coming in because they haven't heard lots of words spoken to them over time. And if you can target vocabulary development, they can develop a vocabulary, they don't have a learning gap, and they aren't identified as special education students. We fund 11% of students in the state as we provide funding for 11% of students to be identified as special ed, but we identify about 13.4% as having a learning disability. We over-identify. And part of the reason that we do is because we don't have this nailed down as well as we need to. It's better. 85 districts across the state now implementing this model. Sorry. I get excited.
And that was districts, not schools.
It's districts, yes. 85 districts. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr.
Senator Thompson.
How come only 85?
Co-chairs Compton Monroe, Senator Thompson. Great question. I had that conversation earlier today with the co-chairs. This is something where we've invited districts to participate. So in the response to intervention roll-up, we've said, we have this. If you want it, you can have it, but this is the commitment that it takes from you. We'll come in, we'll provide you with professional development and training. You need to buy off on the response to intervention methodology, and you need to implement it with fidelity, and we're going to support you in that. And if you do it, great, and if you don't, then we'll probably just stop supporting you. And so those districts that have wanted to participate have, and those that have not wanted so far have not. It becomes more and more of a challenge for districts to not participate when the results keep coming out positive.
Yes, and it's called local control.
So one of the questions, too, is how does this impact, you know, students of color? And so we wanted to use some of the districts that we supported over the last biennium, 13-15, with some of the results that we're seeing. And I'm going to show you five different slides. I'll move through these quickly. Bottom line, you need to look on the left and then look on the right and see if the bar graphs are higher on the right or the left. If they are, we're doing something. And we have demographic breakouts. It's total white. Latino is the blue, purple is limited English proficient, and economic disadvantage is the brown. And you'll see here that across the board there are increases in student learning. I'd like to see them all even up, but we're still seeing increases in Eagle Point, and hopefully we'll see some additional increase over time. We can do the same thing in Klamath Falls. This one is a little bit interesting because the white goes down, but all the other student populations go up. Don't know that I can explain it. I'd have to probably really dig into Klamath Falls to get that. It is sort of an anomaly. Look at Milton Freewater, where we go from 69% reading to 76% reading and up across the board. I mean, I love that one. Same thing with Three Rivers. And these are typical of what we see in different districts. So in conclusion, we had 25 districts total in 13-15 with the resources that were extended. Currently, the regional RTI, we have regional RTI centers in Roseburg, Bend, and Ontario, and in Tigard. So these are centers where we have a staff person or two that support the districts that are part of the network. And then we certainly have data that indicates promising results for student outcomes. And with that long-winded stuff, I will turn it over to Wendy Wilson, principal at John Wetton. Wendy,
welcome.
Thank you for being here.
Good morning. Good morning. Co-Chair Comp and Co-Chair Monroe, nice to be here. Pleasure to be here. So I'm Wendy Wilson. I'm the principal at John Wetton Elementary School, and that's in Gladstone. We're elementary, first through fifth grade, 800 students. So lots of kiddos in a very small district. I've been there. I'm just finishing up my fifth year as principal there. And prior to that, I worked in another district, North Clackamas, and in that district, I had some experience with Oregon RTI. Not in the capacity that I'm in now, but I certainly saw some really great results and got to work with that. So as I'm working with this staff of, 34 teachers, and realizing that they, just like most teachers across America, working really hard and wanting their best for kids and really wanting good success rate, we just were not seeing it at all. And so a couple years ago, got an opportunity to apply for the Oregon RTI grant. And just as Rob said, with that, though, comes some commitments and so and promises. And so I was very excited, probably one of the best days of my career, when I found out that Oregon RTI was willing to work with us with the stipulation that, number one, we would adopt a new strong core reading program. And that was a few years ago, not a lot of money to be said in most school districts. And so that was a commitment on the part of our district to say we're going to move forward and purchase a pretty hefty strong reading program, of which we did. And so that really launched us into our RTI. I will say to you that their support and structure has really given us the vision to move forward. And that's just what I really want to share with you. Is that over the course of the last 2 years, with the adoption of this new reading program, has come really a direction for us with a coach, and she's a go-getter. And she's worked with me just really intensely, helped me to provide really direction to our staff. And so when I say that, a core reading program means that every student receives a minimum of 90 minutes of reading every single day. It's that structure of Oregon RTI that says that's 90 minutes of good instruction, and what does that look like? And so with that coach, I've been able to learn what that really does look like and get into classrooms on a daily basis and really provide actionable feedback to our staff. And that's been good, because those conversations around what does good instruction look like and what do we need to do to raise the bar have been, I'm really on a daily basis. Also, with this coach, she said to me last summer, she said, you know, there's a really great workshop in Oregon, Anita Archer workshop, explicit instruction, and if you could get a few staff to go with you, that would be great. Well, I got 19. And that just tells you where teachers were coming from. And I said, I'm on board, let's go do this. And so we all went to this week-long workshop. Summertime, you know, they're giving up their time. It was amazing. We came back with instructional and engagement strategies that were out of this world. I'm on the phone with the coach, and she's saying, okay, Wendy, what are your next steps? You've got 19 people now that have a lot of skills. What are you going to do with it? And out of that came a leadership team, really from my building, teachers that were ready to roll with it, saying, let's take this and do something on a monthly basis with it. So since then, every month this school year, we provided real professional development on-site with teacher leaders and myself, really teaching everyone else how to do these things. And so again, you've got now a group of people that are teacher leaders that are moving the work forward with good instruction. So good curriculum, good instruction, and then coaching. And with Oregon RTI, it's the structure for us, because as you probably know, there's a lot of mandates on schools. There's also a lot of really fabulous initiatives. And, I mean, I can dream about it every night and think, okay, what should we do next? With this structure, it's really, here's a direction. I need to keep my focus and move forward. I remember last year talking to our coach, and she said to me, you know, Wendy, hold on. Don't get started on, if you will, interventions until you have your core reading program in place. And so, again, the support and the structure around one step at a time, and do it right, and you'll do it well. And so good instruction, good curriculum, good coaching on site, that's really been our focus. We've got now what we call PLCs, professional learning communities or teams, if you will. That is now, there's a structure to that. We look at our data ongoing. We make decisions about how we're going to, whether we're going to intervene with students or whether we're going to provide stronger in the classroom during that 90-minute reading block. Those are all decisions that are made really at our level with the teachers as part of that process. I honestly don't know how I could advocate stronger for a program, but I mean, they're making the difference for us. End of our second year, we're seeing good things happening in our building. I know I'll share a little bit of the data, but we did a survey a few months ago, and the survey was asking all of the staff, how is the culture? How's the leadership? Do you feel good about the reading program? Do you feel good about data? We had some outstanding results. I mean, 100% of those who responded said, culture-wise, we're on board. We're moving forward. This is looking good. Thank you. the survey just told us so much about the leadership happening, the good data work that we're doing, and really the direction that we're moving. As far as our student outcomes, they're testing as we speak. I'm excited about that. But already we've seen, I think it's a 9% growth just from our kids that were not reading to the ones that are reading now. And that's just over the course of a half a year. So very, very positive. Any questions?
Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Co-Chair. So with those teachers that took that extra week of their summer that got really involved and put a lot of their own time into this, were you able to give, and you saw great results, were you able to give them some type of an award, a bonus for their efforts, for their achievements? I mean, I think that's what's lacking in some of the things that we do in the school industry. We don't get to reward teachers for those extra efforts and stuff. What did you do with that bunch?
Thank you, Senator Thompson, Comp and Monroe. I wish I had a billfold full of money that I could say thank you so very much. To be honest, we celebrate that just as a staff, and so no monetarily, but being able to bring them to the front and have other teachers go in and watch the way that they're teaching, that means a lot to a teacher. For me to go into a classroom and give feedback and say, I'm noticing that, we videotape a lot. We do peer observations. That's meaningful to a teacher. A salary increase, wonderful, but it's just not where we're at in any way. And so there's a variety of ways that we really celebrate that as a staff. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, and I know we're on a tight time schedule, but having a principal sitting here and testifying, and you just shared that your students are taking the Smarter Balance assessment.
Oh, yes.
And seriously, what would you share with us as legislators? Should we or shouldn't we support an opt-out?
Oh, mercy.
I know.
Only easy questions. For the
I'm sorry,
thank
but
you for the question.
But I mean, seriously.
I can respond as best from my position as
right.
I possibly can. The level of rigor is intense. I will say that. There are students that are shaking their head and saying, oh my goodness, and teachers too. We are doing our best. And I know that my goal is that we'll get kids to that level. Are we there yet? Absolutely not. It's tricky. Not just the rigor of it, but actually the taking of it, if you will. It's such a different format than it's ever been. And for some schools, the lack of technology and that support and being able to really navigate those systems, that adds another dimension to this. So,
and was that decision made by your school or by your district?
To
whether to have parents opt out or not?
By our district.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Co-chairs Compton Monroe, I want to say thank you very much to Wendy for being here. Obviously, it's great to hear a practitioner. She describes it what I hear them doing really speaks to me because I've watched those things.
Been there.
And here's a point I want to make too, is that there are places that get these grants, any kind of grant, and for whatever reason, oftentimes, maybe leadership, it doesn't go. It just doesn't go anywhere. And so I just want to thank Wendy not only for being here, but for the great work that she's done in implementing this. It doesn't just happen. It takes really strong leadership, and she's clearly providing that. So thank you.
My pleasure.
And we have one last question. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, and thank you so much. It is really exciting to hear about how it has worked in your district. And I just want to send you out with a softball. So you mentioned that your school is 1 to 5 and not K to 5, or did I mishear?
That is correct.
Oh, that's interesting. Where are your kindergartners in Gladstone?
They're at the Kindergarten Center. It's called the GCCF, Gladstone Center for Children and Families, and they're with a variety of other agencies that are there. It's kind of a unique situation. It's quite good. Six sections, so there's 180 kindies that are basically half a mile away. We
Great.
Call it the long hallway.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
Yes, we really appreciate your time and leadership.
My pleasure. Thanks. Glad to be here.
Co-chairs and Representative Smith Warner. So Gladstone is really an example for the state about something that they've done where they've created a hub-like atmosphere where they've brought the community together in this one center to serve their kindergartners. And their early childhood is really impressive. If you ever get a chance to go, I know the superintendent loves to show it off. All right. So we had $2 million for this in the last biennium. We're not seeking any. In this biennium for the replication of Oregon RTI, we do have some federal monies. For that, we have, I think, about $1.5 million in federal funds to continue with the RTI scale-up. You can imagine this is one of my very favorite things. I know that it works. There are many other good things as well, and I'm sure we'll have some conversation down the road.
Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry, I'm so chatty this morning, Rob. I just feel obliged to ask. So you're clearly very passionate about this. The numbers are very impressive. Why no state funding request?
Co-chairs Compton Monroe, Representative Smith Warner. There simply are too many other, competing interests and initiatives that are out there. We have not had any discussions since the newest revenue forecast. So we'll have to think about that.
Thank you.
Eastern Promise replication. Andy Gardner, I know from the San Diego School District, is here and is going to join me as I talk about this, and then he'll have a couple things perhaps to say about the replication of Eastern Promise. So the Eastern Promise and Eastern Promise replication grant was a $4 million Eastern to the Eastern Promise to complete both the work being done at the Eastern Promise and then also a scale-up of 5 new regions to replicate the Eastern Promise, which is really exciting for us. One post-secondary institution, Eastern Oregon State College, and 5 consortiums comprised of 60 school districts, 15 post-secondary, 7 community-based organizations, and 5 ESDs. So this is a big scale-up across the state, and we're going to I just think that this is an absolute game-changer on the college-going frontier in the state of Oregon, and you'll hear a little bit about that from Superintendent Gardner in a moment. So in early on in 12-13, the Eastern Promise itself delivered 4,135 credits at $10 per credit to students in the roughly 22 school districts out in Eastern Oregon, some of them tiny little districts that are offering college credit to their kids through this effort. And then just a year later in 13-14, they delivered 13,800 college credits at $10 per credit, which is really impressive. And we decided to help them finish their work with some of the dollars and then, of course, again, scale it up in some other places. I think it's important for people to know how this works. And it works because high school teachers, community college professors, and university professors get together and determine what content should be covered in order for it to be actual college-level content. If it's not college-level content, we shouldn't award college credit. If it is, then we and kids can master it, then we ought to. So they get together and decide what that is, and they agree on it. Then the high school teachers teach it, and in the Eastern Promise, then the large-scale assessments get sent to the college professors who do the scoring and determine whether or not the college credit is awarded. So the high school teacher is not doing that in this particular instance of the Eastern Promise. Some of the scale-ups have used slightly different models, but all of them appear to be, in my opinion, quite strong.
Representative Huffman has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Rob, we're fairly new into this, but a few years. So the students that have moved on to the university, have U of O, OSU, the others recognize this credit? Has there been a challenge? Because I served on the Accelerated Learning Task Force, and that was the biggest challenge that I don't think ever really got answered, and that was who would be teaching for college-level credit.
Right. Co-Chairs Compton-Moreau, Representative Huffman, it's a great question and one that comes up fairly regularly. I know that the Eastern Promise is doing some long-scale examination of that. I don't have the results with me today, but I'd be happy to see if I can get those for you before I come back tomorrow. I don't know if I can or not, but I'll certainly make the effort, and if not, then I'll get them for you in the next couple of days. My contact out there, making sure that I can get that for you tomorrow.
Sure, follow up.
But it appears, I think it appears that the outcomes look good.
Okay, it's important. I mean, I support a variety of methods of pushing down into high school, but if we're not doing it in a manner that it's going to count for the students, then we're just kind of making ourselves feel good in this building.
Right. So Co-Chairs Compton and Representative Huffman, yes. It's my understanding at this point that the credits that students earned are being recognized when they go to other schools. I know that at times there are challenges that are being thrown up to that. I would certainly hope that as we have a P-20 system, that when kids earn college credit in the state of Oregon, and it's verified by a college in the state of Oregon, that colleges would accept the credit that transfers in as a college credit. That's part of what a P-20 system is supposed to be about, is that we take away some of the things that don't make sense to any of us, to parents, to kids, to legislators, and to me as the deputy superintendent. The idea that a student would earn a college credit in a school in the state of Oregon, that's a public school, and matriculate to a college and have it be a credit that they earn from one college in the state and not transfer to another as a college earned credit makes no sense whatsoever. And I would hope that we don't see that. I don't think we're seeing that happen. I would hope that we not see that happen as we move forward. Part of that, though, to make sure that it doesn't happen is to know as we put this together that the content being covered is actual college-level content, and that the students are mastering it to a degree that makes it irrefutable that they should receive that credit. So that's part of the work that's got to be done by people like this.
Senator Roblin.
And I really agree with this. I think one of the things is that there are credits and there are credits as well. And sometimes they accept the credit, but it doesn't meet a requirement in their major. It doesn't meet a requirement in their general studies. And so it's there. It's on their transcript, but it doesn't have the meaning that's needed to. I mean, kids need to understand that if they take, especially the core, you know, the writing 121s, the math 100 and 105, whatever those numbers are, those are the ones that really make a difference to kids, and they're getting through the next level. There are a whole bunch of other courses that you can give college credit for, it, but when you go to an analysis of the GRE, does it lead towards a degree or a certificate? If the answer is no, then it's a problem. So,
Co-Chairs Kaufman, Senator Roblin, thank you for saying that. It reminds me that there is a set of credits that have been agreed upon by all Oregon colleges to transfer from one to the other, and it's called the AAOT. And it really is what we call the Oregon Transfer Module, and it is the core classes that a student would take in their freshman year in math, speaking, English, and science, I believe, and it's then transferable to all and promised to be transferable to all Oregon colleges as sort of the base classes that students would take.
Okay, Mr. Representative Hoffman, this is it.
Well, you. You need to quit talking, Rob, because I think of new questions. Remediation has been a big key, and you and Nancy have spoken about OEIB's work on alignment. So in the last two or three years, do you have enough of a track record to let us know if within the Eastern Promise region, students coming out of high school going into higher ed have to take less remedial remediation than you did in the past, or that the rest of the state seems to be suffering under?
Co-Chairs Kaufman, Representative Huffman, I think the key is not me to quit talking, but for you to quit asking all the good questions. I will ask the people out there again for that data, and I know that they're really excited about the results that they're seeing, so I'd be happy to get that for you. There are so many parts, I think, that feed into what we're seeing right now. You know, I used to say 68% of our students take developmental ed courses when they matriculate to community college within 2 years. Recent study now says 75%. That study just came out. Wow. And I know that when students take dev ed courses, the chance that they're going to graduate from high school is like 28%. If you end up in dev ed, you're not going to earn anything, probably. 28% likelihood. It's really bad. It's part of why we needed to ensure that kids take full senior, junior, and senior years, part of why the state board took action to increase the number of kids or percentage of kids that would take full junior and senior years. It's part of why this replication is so important. If we're going to have a junior or a senior show up and take a class that they think is important, we need to have courses that are going to feed what they need. And some of it's going to be college credit courses. I'm excited to show up if I know that this is going to count on my transfer degree, right? My AAOT, my first year of college. I'm excited about coming to class. If I'm not, and I don't take math as a senior, and then I have a summer in between, and then I show up and I take an assessment about whether or not I should place in developmental ed or not, I'm going to be in developmental ed. I was a whole old high school math teacher. You give me a year away from teaching math, and there are certain things that I'm just going to have to go back and look at the book to recall how to do. Have me show up and take a calculus test, forget about it, right? I just haven't done it long enough. And that's what we do to kids, and then we put them in developmental ed, and all of a sudden they're spending their Pell Grant on nothing. And we just can't do that to them.
Okay, you're a third.
I'm way far afield.
Yeah, you're a third of the way through your slides.
I have two more guest speakers today, and I'm going to get them both. So here we go.
We've got at the max 15 minutes.
Part of this is that we want to build a college-going culture, which this does, and it creates a pathway to college. One of the pillars of the Eastern Promise is doing that, creating the pathway to college. I will tell you that it also targets underserved students. Eastern Oregon Promise targeted underserved students in the region. It's been really successful in helping students who normally wouldn't participate in college earn college credit, be first-time college goers in their family,
And you can see that there's an overrepresentation of students of color earning credit. And here there are 29% of students are Hispanic, but 44% are earning college credit through the Promise on those charts. And that's a really impressive thing to see. There are five replication sites. Here you can just sort of see the region and the participants. I'm not going to go through all of those, but we have the High Desert Education Service District and their partners, Multnomah ESD and their partners, Southern Oregon ESD and their partners, Lane ESD and their partners, and the Willamette ESD and their partners. We really didn't have enough money to scale up five. We just dug around and found some more because the one in Southern Oregon was so excited. We were so excited about it, we just could not fund it. And so we figured out how to get it funded, and it's creating great alignment. As I started to say earlier, there's professional development around learning teams where they come together and partner, and it creates alignment about what students ought to be learning in a really important way. It increases rigor. Rigor because I'm taking a class that's college, but also because now my teacher has had an experience in teaching a college-level course, and even if I'm not taking it, they think about instruction differently. And it improves the instruction that all kids are receiving within the region. You can see some of the things that are happening around the college-going culture. And I thought I would have Andrew Gardner, the superintendent of the North San Yam School District, talk to you a little bit about what's happening with the Willamette Promise. They've done, I think that this is the group that has moved the furthest this year with the replication. And it would be a really nice example for you to hear what's happening, Mr. Gardner.
Okay, thank you. Rob, we're going to shut you down for a minute now, but if you have any questions, feel free to ask Rob. So, Coach Harris, Conklin Monroe, a few basic facts here about the Willamette.
Need your name for the record.
Andrew Gardner, superintendent of the North San Yam School
thank
District.
You.
In state and in sublimity. Last year, we became aware of the Eastern Promise replication grants and their availability, and at that time, we had sat in the presence of the 40-40-20 goal, wondering how we might begin to move towards that. The superintendents group that meets in Salem here at the Willamette ESD, which is all of the area superintendents, we have been joined by Chemeketa and Western Oregon, and we're really just looking for a vehicle to take some direction. And when these grants were let out, we immediately saw the potential and lined up all of the public school districts in this region along with the four colleges, Chemeketa, Western Oregon. We also significantly added the Teaching Research Institute at Western Oregon as the major research element. They also do all of our measurements in this grant at this time, and so they're committed to the long term for some of the really long term measures. OIT, as well as Corbin College, also are players. Matt Lucas of Corbin sits on the advisory board here. And so that group submitted a plan to provide a credit offering at all of our area high schools. All of the high schools stepped up and offered that this year. We run professional learning communities regionally through the Willamette ESD. And there's, I believe, and this is a little bit flexible, but I think 1,028 new credit hours were offered in the region, so to the different high schools. I believe Fall City High School, way out just near the Coast Range, I believe offered three courses through this by attending PLC. So it was a way, much like the Eastern Promise, to deliver college-going confidence to kids, even in small schools, where they wouldn't necessarily look for. Even at state and high school, where I am, we don't necessarily say we need someone with the ability to teach this in college as our first priority. We look for people that have dual certificates, you know, that can we can have teach several things. Student body advisors, there's a lot of things we look for. Many of our teachers have masters, though, and many of them are great teachers. And if you look past them to the students, many seniors in high school are very, very smart. And the common core in math and reading is aligned to freshman year college, about a B in a class. And so it makes sense for us to PLC with college professors to figure out how those common core standards align then with freshman courses. It's a natural grouping, and they work well together. I want to shout out especially to Western Oregon for their willingness. They have provided great staff. So we got that going this year, and right now the students are awarding, they're getting their credits as the first year draws to a close. And there's a lot of work still to do, mostly longitudinally looking at the success, because the primary function is not to get the kids the credit. The primary success and measure is to get them to college where they will be successful. And that's a year two measure. We have a lot of things that we have to accomplish down the road. And so that's where we're at. As far as state and high school, we were able to offer multiple new courses, and our high school principal did a superb job this year. You have to remember, we're only 1 year in. In 1 year, this March, he put out multiple pathways at state and high school. One of them is the college-bound pathway. It is an OTM, and it resonated incredibly with our parents. I believe it shifted enrollment patterns through open enrollment within the region, just to have us publicizing, this is how you will get your first year of college. Just a really clear set of steps to get through state and high school and on your way to college with a year. And the open house, and I attended that when he rolled that pathway out. We have a fabrication and manufacturing pathway. We have healthcare. There's a hospital out there that we can partner with. Nothing drew the applause like this. This was just a spontaneous eruption. Very powerful, very meaningful. The other thing we're seeing downstream of that is that now there is an incredible conversation. Kids are involved now. There's a peer pressure in picking something that you're going to do. Everything in our high school is more relevant, and this is a huge piece of that relevance at our high school in just this 6 or 7 months of development and rollout. In the future, in next year, we have several groups that I believe are really important to this promise. Our principals are getting together. They have a work group. We want to make sure that all of our schools begin to raise this college-going environment. We also have a counseling group. They work because one of the fundamental premises here is write credits. We do not want someone who is probably going to go into a Bachelor of Science taking a bunch of Bachelor of Arts credits. We believe that right-sizing or write credits is a very important piece of this. So our counselors are also, and that was a new element that we hope to share back with Eastern Promise that came in ours, to make sure that our kids are taking the right credits and don't have a bunch of credits they don't need that they carry along with them. So I'm done. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Before you leave, and I know we have two more presenters.
Really quick.
Okay, Senator Rowland.
So are you combining Eastern Promise with the fifth year program that a lot of the Willamette Valley people are using, where you get the full enrollment while they go to some of their courses at the college?
They are distinctly separate.
Okay, so you're using both, but differently.
Yes.
Okay.
You're not doing a fifth year program.
We are this next year.
Isn't it nice when you learn something every day?
And, just wanted to point that out. What's happening?
Yeah. Well, thank
you.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Superintendent Gardner, and home of the Eagles. Fly on.
Thank you, Chairman Monroe and Comm. Thank you, Senator Rowland.
Thank you.
So there's no doubt there's a ton of turf in this, right? You start mixing college, community colleges, four-year colleges and universities, school districts, ESDs, and regions, and roll this out. There's a lot of turf. I just will repeat, I think this is the game changer around 40-40-20. So we had $4.4 million request last time. We're requesting $3 million this time. Part of the biggest difference here is that Eastern Oregon, the Eastern Promise itself, has finished their replication work largely. And so what this $3 million would do would be to continue to support the five who have begun their work for another biennium to get that finished, and then create one more replication site, $500,000 per site for $3 million total. Dual language grant. If I can get through this, then the last speaker that we've invited can do that, and so that would be wonderful. I'll try to move quickly. We had $1.3 million awarded to seven school districts and one state charter school. Research shows that outcomes for students who participate in dual language programs is much higher than for those who do not. And this basically allowed seven new dual language programs to begin. High quality two-way dual language immersion programs take many years to develop, and full implementation of programs really isn't measurable for 5 to 6 years, because it typically, what happens is you start and you add one grade at a time. So kindergartners come in, for example, and they're in a dual language program, and then they go to be first graders and then second graders, and until 5 or 6 years later, your whole elementary school has a component of dual language. It's really hard to do dual language with fifth graders who have never done, and to instruct them in a different language, right, if they've never done that on the way up. So the dual language grant recipients, you can see, are spread out across the state, which we like. There are some interesting combinations there. Six of the districts, all on the western part of the state, received $120,000 to create the grant, and one school district in partnership with a charter school out there in eastern Oregon, those two little balloons out there, received $160,000. And I should have invited Deborah Armendariz to come up here when I started talking about dual language. Deborah is the senior director of dual language immersion for Portland Public Schools and is going to talk about this for just a moment as a practitioner. Deborah, thank you for being here.
Thank you. Co-chairs Comb and Monroe, members of the subcommittee, it's a pleasure to be here with you today. My name is Debbie Armendariz, and I am the senior director of the dual language program in Portland Public Schools. We have a long history of immersion programs. We have over 25 schools that are immersion sites with 15 programs over 5 languages, including Spanish, Mandarin, Russian, Japanese, and thanks to this grant, Vietnamese. We have over 5,000 students that participate in these programs that are kindergarten through 12th grade. And the impact on students, particularly English language learners, cannot be overstated. We know through bodies of evidence that are much longer than our own history with immersion, that when we put English language learners, when we put them in an environment that supports their native language development, we put them on a trajectory to success. And we also know through cognitive science and neuroscience that bilingualism and biliteracy takes a long time to develop, and that when students do reach high levels of dual language proficiency, they have cognitive advantages that range through all sorts of things, including perhaps calculus testing. So we are very happy to be able to provide those programs for so many of our students. It's about 13% of our students that are on this trajectory, but at kindergarten, it's about 20% of our students. Mm-hmm. So in no time at all, about a fifth of our students, and if we continue expanding, about a fourth of our students will be learning in this environment. I have a whole list of accomplishments, tasks, activities that I can share with you around what we have been able to accomplish with this program. But since time is short, I think what I will do is share with you a story. The grant that we received allowed us to open up the first Vietnamese immersion program in the state. We're very proud of that. The Vietnamese population in Portland Public Schools has been the second largest for a really long time, and yet we have not been able to provide an immersion program in that language for a variety of reasons. I have on my phone, I'm sure as you do, I have a whole bunch of pictures of my own children, but I have a picture of a child that's not mine, and that's a Vietnamese student on the first day of this new immersion program with his father's arm around him, and he's writing in Vietnamese the child's name. So that child was put on a trajectory not only to academic success, but one that values the assets, the linguistic and cultural assets that that child brings with them and that parent brings with them. And as one of the components of the grant was that we needed to engage the community and have a collaborative design team for the immersion program. So that involved a lot of Vietnamese food, to my pleasure. And on a particular evening, we were celebrating the launch of the new Vietnamese immersion program. Some of our community-based organizations took us all out to dinner. And there I met a father with a very different story. He shared with us a story of his first day taking his son into kindergarten a few years back, where he had taken him in, and in the midst of all the anxiety and excitement that is kindergarten, a staff member had said to him, "Don't speak Vietnamese to your child." So that father represents a part of our history and no longer a part of our reality, because I like to think in that embrace that that father, whose picture I carry in my phone, in that very embrace of his child, the whole school was embracing him. As a matter of fact, the ripples of that embrace go through our district, they go through our city, as we have a district that embraces the cultural linguistic assets of all of our families. So this grant has allowed us to do that for yet another population. And we know that at the very same time, although we have 30 children in that immersion program, all of our Vietnamese students across our district know that there's a Vietnamese immersion program. And the status of that language and of their culture has been raised within the district, again, within the city. These seven recipients have been able to do that for an entire state. So thank you for doing that. I'll be happy to take questions.
Senator Monroe?
Yeah, my grandson is in the fifth grade at Woodstock.
Fabulous.
In the Mandarin program, and he's been in the Mandarin program since he was three. His mother is half Chinese, so mm-hmm. he's one quarter, mm-hmm. and they wanted to continue that culture. And he's been very successful in that program. He also reads, writes, and does math in English pretty well, too. And he has a grandmother who is a retired teacher to help him with that. That'd be my wife.
That's fabulous. Thank you, Co-Chairs Monroe and Comp. That's exactly the kind of trajectory that we want to put all of our students, and particularly our heritage students who share an ethnic tie to those languages. Thank you for sharing that.
Representative Smith-Warner.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you so much for coming and speaking. You may already know this, but that Vietnamese dual immersion program is in my district, just a few blocks from my house, as a matter of fact. And one of the questions I had, I've been there, I've talked to a lot of folks there. It's really, like, just the stories about how to get curriculum mm-hmm. are fascinating. Mm-hmm. And I do know that one of the issues is that the best form of ELL is dual immersion. It's half native speakers of each language. And I know that they've had issues in getting enough native English speakers to come in and be part of that. And I wondered if you could speak at all to, that's kind of an, I mean, because I think about that when I think about immigrant African communities that are coming here and we're trying to figure out how, I mean, Woodburn has done an amazing job with their ELL because they have those populations of English native speakers and Spanish native speakers that you can integrate that way. And in these communities where, you know, it's harder to find more people who want to do that. And I just wondered if you could speak at all to what you guys are doing to address that.
Absolutely. Co-Chairs Comp and Monroe and Representative Smith-Warner, I would like to address that. As a young immersion program, particularly in a language that has not typically been seen as an economic powerhouse language, it has been a little more difficult to find native English speakers who want to participate in the program. Although, thanks in part to this grant, we've been able to do a lot of outreach and we're getting more and more of those students. I think that's the nature of starting a new program, but as we think about the 5,000 or more than 5,000 students in our programs, most of them are native English speakers. So we'll continue to work with that. I think that the best argument is, as you have stated, that students who participate in an immersion program in any language develop cognitive advantages and perform better on standardized tests in English. So that's definitely a benefit. But since you mentioned languages from Africa, our next language that we're taking up is Somali.
Oh,
so we're excited to be able to provide native language literacy in Somali in working towards an immersion program in Somali.
Thank you.
Thank you. And there's nothing like the enthusiasm of a leader of a program and telling the story. Yes. It makes all of us think about stories of how we've touched hearts in different ways. So thank you.
Thank you.
And Mr. Saxton, how are we going to transition here?
Co-chairs, I know that looks like we're Are we out?
Yeah.
And we're at slide 50. I think there's like 104, and the ones tomorrow will move much faster than the ones today.
Sure.
I give you my promise, and I don't have guest presenters tomorrow either. I would emphasize only that, these dual language programs, it takes something to start one. And it's scary. As a superintendent, I started a couple. And it's hard. The work with staff and the work with the community and then leveraging some dollars to actually start it, it's hard to do. And yet it's irrefutable that the long-term outcomes for kids are just way better than any other way to go. Right? And that's for our native English speakers and our native speakers of whatever other language it is you're supporting in Tiger 12, and it was Spanish. And replicating these across the state is an important effort so that people begin to realize what we can accomplish, and then districts decide that they want to take this up in their own cause as we move down the road. But we need some more replication to build the sort of the wave of movement that it'll take to cause that.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'll finish up in fine speed and fashion tomorrow. Thank you
okay.
for your time today.
And I'm going to close the public hearing on 5016, and committee will adjourn. Thank you, and see you tomorrow. Thank you, and see you tomorrow.